And welcome to Stirring the Pot. I'm Linda Nygaard, and I'll be your host for the next 30 minutes. I'm in the studio of Voice of Vashon, downtown Vashon, Washington. And it is the 3rd of September. We're moving right into fall. And sitting here with me is Mr. Tom Conway of Tall Clover Farm. Hi, Tom.
Bonjour.
How are you today?
I'm good. I was ready to start singing that song. It was the 3rd of September. A another, day I'll always remember.
Another misty something.
Because that was the day that my daddy died.
Oh.
No, it's a song.
Oh, it's a song.
It's not real. No. Sorry. I wouldn't start the show on that kind of downer.
Wait, about your daddy's death.
No.
That's like the day I tried to talk about murder in the kitchen.
Yeah, it wasn't.
Okay.
No.
All right, back on track.
It's a family
show. We're live, you know.
Yes, oh, that's right.
Okay, and also with me is Chris Austin, who is here for Sparkling Conversation and Woody Remarks.
The adult in the room.
Running the board for us. Yeah. Hi, Chris. Yes, I'm glad you're here. You know, I'm not sure that all of our listeners know that Tom and Chris each have their own show. And Tom's show is on before mine?
No, there's been a rescheduling.
Yeah,
I'm on after you.
Okay, so look for Tall Clover Farm. And yeah. Tom...
Are the shows called In Tall Clover?
In Tall Clover, that's right.
Yeah.
And what's your website?
TallCloverFarm.com.
Okay, that's where I was confused. Okay.
Yeah.
So you can go to his blog at Tall Clover Farm. Yes. And Chris's show. Chris, do you want to tell us about your show?
The Mostly True Radio Show. Fridays, 4 to 6. It's stupid stories and
2 hours
and
man.
Music.
It's stupid stories. It's
completely
funny
unscripted
stories, and they're not stupid, but it's a really enjoyable show, and I would encourage you all to listen to it.
Yeah, if I had to wait 2 hours in a ferry line with somebody, I would want it to be Chris because he's got good stories. Yeah. He has very good stories.
Mostly true.
Mostly true.
Well, you know, here we are at the beginning of our autumn season, and it's something we all look forward to, I think, at some point, and then, of course, we dread the rain that's coming, but, you know, it's coming. And today, there's a couple of things. It's National Welsh Rarebit Day. You know what Welsh Rarebit is?
As a kid, I thought it was like raw rabbit dish.
I did too. I thought it was like raw rabbits.
Because that's what Bugs Bunny would say. He would. He did. I swear there's an episode about Welsh rabbit.
Well, it's it actually is really toast and cheese, but it's not just regular cheese. You have to use really good cheddar cheese and a nice crispy big bread, and you make a cheese sauce. It's basically, you know, white cheese sauce, and you put it over the toast and you eat it.
The rabbit cheese?
No, there's nothing. It has nothing to do with rabbits. It came from Wales, and the mispronunciations got the rarebit went to rabbit.
Oh.
And so there's never been a rabbit involved. However, there is some indication that in the 16th century, there was a tale that God, you know, the Welsh have not always been highly prized individuals, and they've been accused of a lot of things. I have a ancient
in England or worldwide?
Well, probably worldwide, but I know in my family, my grandfather was Welsh, so there was a lot of defense of the Welsh. And apparently, somewhere back in Wales, I have an uncle that got hanged because he was a horse thief. So they came to America.
This explains so much.
Wow. You know, the Welsh, they're not sending their finest over here, the Welsh.
Anyway, here's a story that really sort of goes with how things are happening today. The tale tells how God asked Saint Peter to get rid of the Welsh from heaven because they just caused such a ruckus wherever they were.
So harsh.
I know. So Saint Peter stomped outside the pearly gates and shouted, "Welsh rarebit!" To which all the Welshmen duly tumbled out excitedly, allowing the gates to be slammed and shut behind them.
Wow.
Now, can you imagine? They told that story. I hope I'm not in trouble for that.
That's kind of hurtful. But, you know, DNA doesn't lie.
Okay, we'll get off that subject now. But I'm going to try some Welsh rarebit for dinner tonight.
What kind of bread are you going to use?
I don't know. I haven't gotten it yet. Probably something from Essential.
Yeah.
Bakery. Something really crusty dense. Make a white sauce. I have some really good cheddar cheese.
Maybe add some. This is my problem. Like, I like the idea of the recipe, and then I go like, you know, this would be really good with a pork chop on it.
Sometimes they put an
bacon.
Egg on it. They put it like a poached egg. Oh, you can put bacon on it.
Or a big fat slicer of tomato.
You can put bacon. You can do all of that. It's the sauce that's the component you have to have, that you must have. There's mustard in it. There's Worcestershire sauce. So anyway, that's what kind of day it is today.
Nice.
Yeah. And then I want to talk a little bit about something I discovered, a recipe I discovered this month. And it's called, don't laugh, chocolate chip sheet pan pancakes.
Holy sheet.
And the thing is, it's a recipe I got out of the New York Times, and it is pancakes, and you do it in a sheet pan, so you have like a great big rectangle of pancakes. And I have to tell you, I had huge sort of hesitation about it. I thought there's no way, because you have to do a pancake, has to be round, it has to be on the griddle. Well, these were just delicious, and I think you can attest to that.
I can. I walked into her cute apartment and smelled so good, and you had browned butter in the pan, mm-hmm. and then you were just ready to pour the batter in, which was, you know, like a heavy, it's very, very thick.
It's very heavy. It's more like a biscuit dough, kind of.
Yeah.
It's not quite.
Mm-hmm.
But
how do you flip it?
You don't. You just bake it.
Oh.
You just spread it
unflipped
on.
Unflipped pancake.
Yeah.
This is an outrage.
I'm not a chocolate chip person in my pancakes ever, ever, ever. So I just eliminated those. I was going to try blueberries in it. And I thought, no, my rule for new recipes is to do it three times.
Mm-hmm.
The way the recipe says, so that I know how it acts.
Unless there are chocolate chips in it.
Right. Well, then I wouldn't even try.
Yeah.
But I left those out, and I've tried it once now. This recipe.
Yeah, I was amazed how good they were. I was skeptical too, as she was pouring the concrete, sort of concrete thick mm-hmm. batter into the pan and smoothing it out and trying not to burn ourselves.
And trying not to look guilty for not making real pancakes.
We locked the door to make sure no one was watching us. And they were, I'm going to use a word no one ever uses, awesome.
Not
they were
that
totally
word.
Awesome.
Yeah, they were really, really good. And then we discussed whether or not we thought they would freeze well.
Uh-huh.
They don't.
Okay.
So
they
I tried
sog
it.
Out or something?
Well, it's just hard to get them to stay in shape.
Oh.
And they break when they're not sturdy. So mm-hmm. the next time you have, you know, 4 to 6 people for breakfast, 4, I think,
mm-hmm.
maybe. For that, it's a recipe in New York Times. Just look up New York Times sheet pan pancakes, and you'll come to the recipe. They're very good.
You know, I really liked it. I think for me, because I like to sometimes I have to bake things based on the utensil I own, and so I would normally do that, but now I won't because I have this cute little it's probably about 60 or 70 year old. Pancake pan that has indentations in it for silver dollar pancakes.
Oh,
and so it's pretty cool.
Yeah,
and then you flip them, and you know, and your guests are in awe of your perfectly formed silver dollar
and your
pancakes.
Culinary talents,
exactly.
Yeah. Oh well, that's a good
I'm very
idea.
Insecure.
Yeah, it's the pan that does the work.
It's the pan that makes me look good.
Yeah. Well, speaking of kitchens, one of the things I want to talk about today, or that we seem to talk about a lot, is kitchen. Identity and what we have in there and how much we love it and how we feel about it. You know, the kitchen, the old saying is that it's the heart of the home. We all know that. That's kind of mm-hmm. cliche now. But when you think about it, your living room is a place where everyone, you know, gathers for peaceful conversations or reading books or whatever. And the kitchen table is the place where it all happens. I mean, there's card games and babies and, you know, grandmothers and big meals and little meals and lots of tears and all kinds of human things happen at the kitchen table, as well as eating.
No, most true. I think
that's where all parties end up, right?
Yeah,
all
true.
End up in the kitchen.
The host will be managing like 14 hot pans boiling with water and an olive oil
and saying, excuse me, behind you.
And people will like, it's like they'll just, it's so funny because they'll be leaning on your sink and your counter landing mm-hmm. space.
And there's no room.
And they'll be
there.
Talking about their new yoga pants or something.
Right.
And then the next thing you know is you're looking there, am I in your way? You're going, yeah,
they'll pose in the living room, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Do you, Tom, have a first memorable kitchen?
Oh gosh. Yes. Yeah, because it was my, you know, I think a lot of people would be their grandmother's kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
And I had two grandmothers.
Lucky you.
And so I had one who was into modern, no-fuss cooking.
Mm-hmm.
That was not my favorite kitchen.
I bet not.
But then my other grandmother, they had an old Victorian house in town, and it was a a really wonderfully eclectic neighborhood of, mm-hmm. of characters. And so you could smell, like, there were Italians next door. She was German. My grandfather was Lebanese. So you had this great cross-cultural cooking in there. But what was so great about the kitchen is she had one of those awesome formica tables in it that mm-hmm. sat right by the window. And the ones that had the, they looked almost, streamlined, like they had the chrome.
Sure. Yeah.
The chrome chairs. And it was a perfect place where, like, you'd feel really special. You'd sit in that chair looking out the window at the riffraff and watching the city go by, and you would just be me and her. And so you felt like, you know, it could have been a Parisian cafe. I mean, it was so cool to have. It was more about the person in the room and making the kitchen. Right. And so that's when, because it was like a little sit down, have a coffee break table.
Well, that's a wonderful thing to have, a little breakfast nook like that. I think the first kitchen I remember, beside my mom's, of course, was my grandmother's mm-hmm. in the Rocky Mountains in Canada. And she had, when I was a little girl, like maybe five, she had a general store, and then their home was on the back. The general store was on the front. And in that kitchen was a wood cook stove with a white cat that curled up in front of it. And
my gosh.
And it's the room I remember always, the tea kettle was on, always. And there were wonderful things simmering on that stove. And it's where my aunt, who was 11 years older than I, taught me how to paint my fingernails. And what it was like to be a teenager. And I just remember all that, thinking, oh, she is the coolest thing that ever lived. Mm-hmm. And I was five.
And it was a wood-fueled stove.
Yeah, it was. And I don't remember if she had a regular stove. I'm pretty sure she did. Uh-huh. You know, the wood stove was more heat, I think. I don't know. My aunt will correct me if I'm wrong, because mm-hmm. she listens. But it was really an amazing place for me, because it was always warm. It always smelled good. And there were wonderful things coming out of that oven. And that kind of started my foray into fascination with all things kitchen. What about you, Chris?
Well, what I remember about my mom's kitchen was all the Kentucky Fried Chicken buckets. That was mom's cooking.
Did you get that, like, the deal? Like, when that was like the biggest treat when we would get.
Yeah.
Because you got a series of things with it, or not a series,
potato or mashed potatoes.
Oh, the coleslaw. Biscuit.
And then sometimes they had those big sugar cookies. Have you ever had?
I don't remember those.
Yeah, the one we went to had big sugar, like cakey sugar cookies.
Well, my mom's best friend gave her a 8x10 glossy picture of Colonel Sanders, and she said, "What's this for? Because I want your kids to know who cooks their meals."
That's hysterical.
That's a wonderful story. That is a wonderful story. I think the most fascinating kitchen I've ever been in was. In France, in one of the castles. Have you been mm-hmm. in a castle kitchen? Oh, my Lord. Those stoves are huge, and there's so much beautiful copper hanging. And I, you know, it's sort of like that upstairs, downstairs thing.
Yeah.
On PBS.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Oh, man, I was just completely fascinated by that. And the one that I loved was in Chenonceau, which is over the Loire Valley. And it had hand-forged pot racks and custom wooden tables everywhere. So there was lots of chopping and mm-hmm. a special place to knead the bread. And unlike kitchens like yours and mine, which have, like, you know, a 2x2 foot space for mm-hmm. landing things on, these were just huge. And ever since then, I've always
roller
thought,
skate in them.
What would it be like to have a big, giant, wonderful kitchen?
Yeah. You know, there's a kitchen that I like in the U.S. that is a jam kitchen, and it's in on Cape Cod. It's in Sandwich.
Oh my.
Is that Sandwich, Massachusetts? And it's so great. And it's been going since, I think it's a nonprofit now, but it's an act, they make jam there, and it's nonprofit anyway. But it has this giant long table of gas burners. It's two deep, and then it goes mm-hmm. about 20 down, and they have pots of jam on every single one. And then they have an evaporative window where they put the jam pots after they're at a certain stage where the sun's heat evaporates it for a more subtle and delicate flavor without being burnt or scorched. Anyway, it's pretty cool. It's a really cool place.
Is this a commercial endeavor for somebody? Is it like a
in the Victorian times, it used to be like a train stop, and it was like all the wealthy people going out to the Cape uh-huh. would stop and get jellies and jams for gifts. And but it's been going on for probably 100 years now.
Well, I'd like that too. Yeah. We could have fun with that. I think we could probably have a lot of fun with that. I've kind of always wanted a spit and a fireplace in a kitchen.
Oh, yeah.
Like they had in the olden days, mm-hmm. you know, where you have a cauldron hanging from the hook and the spit. I was looking at some photographs of old kitchens like mm-hmm. that in big mansions that have those. And the gear that it takes to crank the spit around is pretty intense.
Yeah, I know that I've done it when we've had power outages. Mm-hmm. I've cooked on my, I really have. And it's been kind of a hoot. It's not as easy as one would think.
No,
would
it
think.
Isn't. No.
I have a couple of friends of mine on the island who have a fireplace in their kitchen, and they're really good cooks. And they do this thing that just fascinated me, and it was so good. They took a chicken mm-hmm. that they're going to roast, mm-hmm. and they tie it up so it's hanging from a twine. And then they put it on a hook in front of the fireplace mm-hmm. with a pan underneath.
And they roast it that
way. And they
way.
Spin it. Yeah. Like, you know, they rotate it. And then it goes back and forth for about 10 minutes. And then you do it again. And it just keeps going back and forth, spinning back and forth. And it acts like a rotisserie, a vertical rotisserie.
So do you have to spin it?
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
So you have to take turns spinning uh-huh. the chicken.
Go, hey, spin a chicken.
Well, excuse me, but I have a friend whose forte is spinning a chicken. When she has one of those old 1950s.
Oh, you're serious.
I am serious.
I thought it was a euphemism.
No, she has one of those old round roaster things, and you stick the chicken on it,
uh-huh.
and it turns and turns and roasts. It's got electric coils all around it.
Oh, yes.
And so she found one at a thrift store and loved it and brought it home and made a chicken. And now every time she invites me for dinner, she says, I'm going to spin a chicken. You want to come over?
Is it an old appliance?
Yeah, it's from the 50s.
Oh, so it almost seems like it would be like good for like lamb and shish kebab.
Oh,
if
yeah,
you're doing
you could do that
too.
Yeah, it's really interesting spinning chicken.
That sounds
but
great.
That's, that wasn't on our topic list today, was it?
Well, you know how our topic list goes. Pretty much like we go
I know.
Everywhere.
Well, let's talk about, do you have any more kitchen things you want to say? We were going to talk wax poetic about kitchens, but I don't know if we're going to have time.
You know what? It'd be a great follow-up show. You could have like a kitchen designer
and some, yeah I would like to
Wouldn't
do that.
Wouldn't that be kind of fun?
So let's revisit kitchens in a different show.
Okay.
Let's do that.
Yeah.
Because I really want to talk about the produce that we're running into right now at this season of everything is turned to honey. You mm-hmm. know, everything is just honey in your mouth right now. Because
pretty dreamy.
It's just so good. Most especially, well, you have some plums that you were raving about the other day.
Oh, yeah. I have a lot. It's interesting. If you grow fruit on Vashon, you know, it's some things that you try. You know, you make a deal with God or the devil. Like, please, can I just get like one piece of fruit out of this tree? But some things are relatively easy to grow.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them, plums do particularly well on Vashon, and
so good.
I have a large variety of plum trees, but the one that is such a kick in the pants is the French plum, the Mirabelle, and I call them, they're nature's gumdrops.
Mm. How big are they?
They're about the size of a large Rainier cherry.
Oh, they're little.
They're really little, and they're freestone, meaning that if you bite into them, you can just pop the seed right uh-huh. out. It's easy, but they have a really subtle, lovely sweet flavor. Mm. The texture is really nice, and you can just eat them like popcorn or gumdrops.
Gumdrops, candy.
Yeah, Mirabelle.
Yeah, what color are they?
That is another. They're beautiful. They're just some different varieties of Mirabelle, but the one I have, they look like you dipped them in like orange sherbet and then splattered little raspberry juice dots on them. They're like, yeah.
Nature's design.
Yeah.
Yeah, I
really
love that.
Really pretty.
Well, I might have to come over and try one.
Yeah, I was supposed to bring him today, and I apologize.
Oh, you don't have to apologize.
Okay.
I'll catch up with you.
You know where I live.
I know where you live. The other thing that I think is really hot right now and so juicy delicious are the tomatoes.
Mm-hmm.
Tomatoes right now are just so good. And do you have a certain thing you do with tomatoes when they're at this time of year?
Do you know, I really do like, I love tomatoes, but I find that for me, this time of year, I don't do anything with a tomato that isn't fresh.
That isn't fresh, yeah.
Yeah, like I don't make sauce, but I make salsa, you mm-hmm. know, and I, you know, eat 800 BLTs by October.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So I'm always just sort of eating them fresh with either mozzarella or on a sandwich or there's a friend of mine who had a recipe, which sounds ridiculous, but he would pour warmed butter and sea salt over the tomatoes.
Yeah.
It was like crazy good. Ooh. And he'd just eat it with fresh bread, not the toasted stuff that cuts your mouth, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, like sometimes bruschetta is really a weapon.
Well, I figure when I make my Welsh rarebit tonight, the bruschetta will be kind of soaky.
It'll
be soaky, whatever.
It won't injure you.
Hopefully not, because that's a severe injury sometimes. Well, have you ever made tomato bacon jam? Have you ever had it?
No, I haven't. I was thinking about it, but I haven't. I've had just tomato jam.
Mm-hmm. Well, my passion at this time of year is tomato bacon jam. And I don't can it because I don't like that process. I don't enjoy that process. But
It does take 10 minutes. That's true.
No, it's all the boiling and the cleaning and the, you know, all that. I mean, I do sterilize the jars, obviously. But you can make a nice little batch of tomato bacon jam, give it to friends, and it'll last for a month in the fridge.
Okay.
And it's fabulous with cheese or on chicken and fish. Mm. It's just so good. I love it. And I have a recipe for it, and I will post that on the website after.
Yeah, I would love that. I'll make it.
Okay, good.
Do you like, what kind of bacon do you use? Like a thick or thin, or it doesn't matter?
It doesn't really matter.
You chop it up.
Preference. I don't think you want it too thick because you don't want too many chunks in there. You want more flavor and more gooiness.
So you're cooking the chicken.
Spinning
the chicken and you're cooking the bacon before you put it in the jam.
Right. And then at the end, you do everything in your food processor or your blender or whatever to reach the desired thickness or consistency.
Oh, okay.
So you have a few chunks in there.
Okay.
But I've always used just regular old bacon because I like the flavor of it. And sometimes when you use thick bacon, it changes textures.
Yeah.
You know, and it's kind of hard. So another thing I really love to do with tomatoes is make ketchup.
Oh, yeah.
Have you ever made ketchup, Chris?
I've heard of it.
Have you heard of it?
You know, that is a Northwest thing. When I moved out here years ago, you know, on my wagon train, I was amazed. Like, people, like, it was normal for people to order tartar sauce with French fries. And I go,
ew.
Haven't you ever heard of ketchup? You
know, yeah.
Be like, or malt vinegar.
Yeah. Well, you know, ketchup is kind of a fascinating story in that it do you spell it with a K or a C?
I spell it with the K, which I think is the way Heinz 57 does.
Ketchup.
Yeah. Because the other way is ketchup.
Ketchup. And that's what my grandmother said was ketchup.
Yeah.
It was ketchup. Well, I found out where that came from, and it came from...
The Welsh.
No, it came from the Chinese, and they had a fermented condiment that they called kai sip. I can't really say the word, but it spelled similarly to ketchup, and... When the Dutch and the English heard it, they heard that word. And so they came back to their countries with this wonderful condiment. Well, this wonderful condiment at that time had no tomatoes in it whatsoever.
Oh.
Mm. And so, you know, we were talking earlier about that's why they call it tomato ketchup, because there were so many different kinds of ketchup. The Victorians were trying to make ketchup. And they were using walnuts and mushrooms and all kinds of things except tomatoes.
Hmm.
And then finally, somebody thought they should have some tomatoes in there. So they did. And the first recipe for ketchup is in 1812, written by a scientist.
I think tomatoes had sort of people were concerned that they were poisonous.
They're poisonous.
They thought they were poisonous. Yeah. Yeah, you weren't supposed
because
to eat
the vines
them.
Are.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
But the fruit, the berry isn't.
Yeah. And then there's a guy named, what was his name? Wiley.
Coyote.
No, Dr. Harvey Washington Wiley, who did a lot of talking about preservatives and acids and those kinds of things when you're canning. And so that came up with the tomatoes and the ketchup. So Wiley partnered with a man in Pittsburgh whose name was Henry J. Hines.
No way.
Yeah, in 1876.
Dang.
And they came up with some names of the Hines ketchup stuff. And I think, Tom, didn't you find something about why is it 57?
Yeah, that he was kind of a branding genius, and it was sort of crazy that the company had so many products that he wanted to sort of distinguish one, and at that time, the branding of a product
Well, nobody really knew branding. I mean, that wasn't
right, but
a thing.
But he was sort of the first one that sort of unwittingly kind of branded mm-hmm. the company mm-hmm. with one product, even though they had so many others. So by inferring, or he inferred that he had 57 products, he actually had more, but he thought 57 was a good number.
He liked the number.
He even toyed with 58 and 59. He said, those are not good numbers.
We want 57. Yeah,
but
precisely.
It has nothing to do with the ingredients or the true product line. He had even more products.
Well, speaking of the ingredients, there is a recipe that I found for spicy umami ketchup, and it's very similar to what they used to make with the fermented fish, and it has something called shrimp sauce in it, which is shrimp paste, basically. Uh-huh. And the recipe cautions Americans to use just a tiny dab because we won't like it.
But what the heck is that flavor?
And it's got soy sauce, dark soy sauce, and it also has tomatoes in it. So I'm going to post that recipe as well. And it's just really interesting how they came to mix the Chinese. But I'm K-E-T-S-I-A-P.
Yep, that's ketchup.
Yep, that's ketchup. And it's just interesting to me how they came from fermented fish to tomatoes.
Yeah, it is, I think, one of the most compelling stories of human our societal evolution is the food. Right. You know, like tomatoes, they're a New World product, and they basically went from the Americas to Europe and Asia and
back.
Basically consumed their cuisines,
right.
As well as, I think, peppers and
right.
pumpkins and potatoes mm-hmm. and corn and
all those things
yeah.
from South America.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, I will tell you that ketchup in the packets that you get at restaurants
uh-huh.
will not last forever.
Oh, it won't?
No, and which ruins my underground bunker plans. So
yeah,
keep that in mind.
So. Well, you know, the thing is, ketchup is different depending on where you go. I think mm-hmm. in America, ketchup's, you know, we all have our favorite brand, whichever that is. But if you are in Europe and you're eating ketchup, it doesn't have nearly the amount of sugar in it that Heinz does, for instance.
Oh.
Heinz ketchup, if you picture a tablespoon of ketchup, just picture that mm-hmm. out of the Heinz bottle, there's a whole teaspoon of sugar in that tablespoon.
Really?
Yeah.
What? Really?
Yes.
That's a third, right? Isn't that three to...
Is it? I don't know.
Yeah.
I should know.
Yeah,
it is, I guess.
Two teaspoons to a tablespoon.
Two?
Three. I know, three. Yeah.
So it's a third.
Son of God.
Yeah, it's a lot of sugar. And most of it, I didn't read the ingredients. But most of it is high fructose corn syrup.
Lucky Charms has got less sugar.
Less cereal than ketchup.
That's crazy. A bowl of ketchup for the kids.
I know it. It's really true.
Wow.
And that's a wonderful reason to
make
your own.
Makes tartar sauce sound better and better.
Doesn't it? Yeah. Right. Yeah. But I'm going to try some of the umami ketchup, too, and I'll share it with you and we'll see if we like it. They're saying it's probably not, you know, you got to be careful with it. And if I were to do the original recipe that does not have the tomatoes in it,
mm-hmm.
it comes with a warning that says this probably would not be good on an American hamburger.
Oh.
So.
Well, I always like it when they use, you know, like ketchup is basically the base for every secret sauce on a burger.
Right.
You know.
And you know, we've been forewarned about that now. So.
I'd say, ooh, mommy.
Yeah.
I don't like this.
Yeah, I know. I know.
I wonder what, if there's ooh, daddy.
That's right.
Well, you know, when you're making ketchup, there's more spice in it, too. You make a little cheesecloth, put the spices in the cheesecloth and make a little spice bag, and it's cloves and garlic and bay leaves. And
what I tend to do is I just put them all in the, when I'm making ketchup, I'll put it all in the, everything I want in the pan itself, and then mm-hmm. and then you reduce it really, really slowly. It's a perfect candidate
for... So you don't do the cheesecloth thing?
No, but what I do is at the end of it, I put it through a strainer, and then that way the strainer catches it all and creates a nice consistency.
So is this tied to your story about what happened when you forgot you had ketchup on the stove?
I'm still 5 years later. I'm still picking little tomato chips off the ceiling. They're little, yes, it's bad.
Yeah, Tom had an interesting experience.
I went and talked to a neighbor who stopped by and forgot I had ketchup on the stove, and it basically was like Mount Vesuvius in my kitchen.
Yeah, it gets pretty thick. And then those bubbles are they're
it's almost like a leather-like consistency, mm-hmm. and then it explodes. And mm-hmm. when it explodes, it shoots the tomato shards of goo everywhere.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I thank you. This went really fast this time. Thank you for being here, and Chris, thank you for your help. I appreciate Absolutely. Everything you do. And to the listeners out there, remember you can email me at stirringthepot@voiceofvashon.com.
But be kind.
Yes, please
be gentle. We're very sensitive.
Our feelings get hurt easily.
That's right. Say nice things.
We will see you again next week. And thank you for listening.